this totally wacky amount of traffic, which I just drove through in the process of dropping off my brother. But there's this outlet mall close to Milton, Ontario, Toronto Outlet Mall. And the volume of traffic. Wow, Boxing Day. And I had this conversation with my brother about it, and just because I'm sitting here dealing with traffic, I figured why not share it into this here podcast. You know, Amazon versus shopping at an outlet mall or something like that. I mean, first of all, like, let's just say something about Boxing Day. Like, as somebody who's concerned about climate change, who's concerned about, you know, finite resources, you know, on our planet, and, you know, the ability for us to, you know, continue to keep our quality of life in a good way on a, you know, in the fixed ecosystem in a finite world, you know, there's a pretty obvious reason to be concerned about just, like, the level of consumption that's just fundamentally unsustainable, you know, particularly in the Western world. Okay, so, all that being said, like, when you're looking at just the like, hunger for these discounts from people, like, you know, already living in a world where we just drive prices down as much as possible through environmental and labor standards, like, you know, I mean, I'll say this, like, we all work way too hard for our money, you know, the amount of money that we make is not kept up with inflation, like, you know, even in the most privileged places in the world, like, you know, we all have good reason to be looking for cheaper access to the things that we need. You know, you can't blame people for wanting to get stuff for cheaper. I for sure pay attention to the price of things when I'm shopping. You know, but there is something to make you wonder about, like, our drive to get more and more consumer products. And you know what? I mean, I love consumer goods as much as most people. You know, I care about which kind of a phone I'm using and that sort of thing. But when you sort of see the mass lineup of people trying to get that product for, you know, just a little bit cheaper. I mean, for one, like, it says something about our susceptibility to advertising. Like, is it really that much cheaper? Like, I know there's deals on Boxing Day, but, you know, if you look at the Boxing Day deals for Best Buy and then you compare it to, you know, their prices on, you know, other sales throughout the year for the same product, there's definitely some manipulation of, like, how much is really on sale. And then when you take into consideration your time, you know, all the gas you're burning, waiting in traffic, eating in a food court, you know, I mean, like, I'm still going and going here, and this lineup of cars is just, like, forever. And I thought it was just traffic, but I realized that it was all people trying to get out at this outlet mall. I'm now past it, thankfully, because I'm moving in the opposite direction, but I see all the people in the, you know, direction I came from earlier, and it's, like, it's clearly, this is what that traffic's all about. It ends right at the outlet mall in both directions. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. But anyway, so my brother and I were talking about Amazon.com, you know, and the ethics of that company. You know, I'm not a big fan of Amazon for a few different reasons. I mean, I think there's really good arguments to be made for antitrust cases to, you know, really limit the power that this company has. I like having products efficiently shipped. You know, definitely seems better to me to have one truck delivering products to people all over the place than everybody driving to the big outlet mall. You know, there's something to, you know, pay attention to there. You know, in the bigger picture, obviously, you know, all of this really just ties into unsustainable levels of consumption, stuff that's made to be disposable to begin with, you know, the driving down of prices through crummy labor laws. The piece that's really jumping at me, though, like, is, you know, this conversation about, like, whether you should shop at one place or the other, you know, kind of voting with your dollars and what you're supporting one way or the other. And, like, quite frankly, I, you know, don't have a lot of faith that shopping with or voting with my dollars is gonna change a heck of a lot. Like, you know, if we're voting with our dollars, I got a lot less votes than somebody else. And not only is that fundamentally undemocratic, but, you know, it's just not an effective mechanism for making change in the world. You know, really the best part about voting with your dollars is, you know, giving your dollars to the better option, to supporting, you know, some better option. But, you know, as I pointed out, like, we don't all have the luxury of a lot of extra dollars to vote with. You know, and there's a lot of people out there who probably would prefer to buy stuff fair trade, but, you know, they got to put food on the table, they got to keep clothes on their kids' backs, and, you know, and even having the time to really know whether something is legitimately better, you know, that the claims being made around ethical labor, environmental standards are accurate. You know, the nice thing is that people care enough about those things that, you know, companies need to make those claims to get customers' attention, but... you know, how valid those claims even are, let alone if you have the money to spend to support them, it's a big question mark. And frankly, you know, if really what you're trying to do is make change in the world in some way, you know, I'd say boycotts are really more useful as a media stunt and as a way to kind of get media attention to put pressure on a company or on a government, you know, than a boycott really ultimately, you know, except in some... You know, very extreme examples where it just makes sense, where there's clear options, where you can pick one over the other and it really is a better choice, where they aren't just owned by the same conglomerate, or, you know, in circumstance where they're even vulnerable to that sort of thing. I mean, like, let's take Amazon as an example. I mean, most people probably don't even know this, but Amazon makes way more money off web hosting, Amazon Web Services, than they do selling crap on their website. And, you know, they're relatively insulated from, you know, the harm that could be done from boycotts. In fact, a lot of the time they lose money on purpose, some suggest, you know, just to corner markets. And this is actually one of the other concerns about Amazon, just to go off on a tangent for a second. Like, you know, one of the big arguments about what should be brought forward as an antitrust concern is that they're both manufacturing and selling products and also acting as a marketplace for other people to sell the same products. And in fact, they use the market data that they have in terms of what's selling on their site from, you know, third parties to make decisions about what products they're going to manufacture and then compete in that marketplace with, you know, the most accurate information about, you know, what prices things are selling at, as well as, you know, just being able to give themselves the best possible placement on the shelf. So, you know, if you're selling a product out there in the world, you have very little choice but sell it on Amazon these days. And as soon as you do, if your product's successful, Amazon might just manufacture that product themselves, undercut you and, like, basically hide your product and make theirs presentable. So, you know, once you've built up the interest in that particular product line, you know, Amazon's really got you over a barrel. So there's that kind of thing to think about. And, you know, I guess it brings me back to, like, ultimately the power that we have is not through voting with our dollars. It's through, you know, the collective power we have in governments. Now, I'm not saying that I have a lot of faith in the political parties and our elected officials, but the mechanism of government, you know, as a tool that we collectively have to regulate, to, you know, enforce rules. I mean, it's usually through pressure put on elected officials that we get this kind of change. You know, there are, of course, some great people who get elected who have the best of intentions and can make change. But it's worth us, of course, remembering that, you know, there's only so much power that that governments have, that we live in a world where corporations, you know, have a seat at the table in a lot of, you know, very real ways. Not just because of the amount of power and influence they have, or not just because of the donations they make, but just because structurally that's just how the world works. Like, a lot of what's being done on our planet, you know, is being done by these companies. And they, you know, not only influence governments, but they're, you know, equal in size and scope and scale, and often bigger in size and scope and scale, you know, these large international conglomerates. You know, are really bigger than individual companies a lot of the time, and, like, actually have seats at the table in international negotiations, whether it be on business issues or environmental issues or labor issues. You know, they often actually sit at the same negotiating table as elected officials are, and of course many of those elected officials are beholden to corporate interests in one way or another for any number of reasons. It might even just be legitimate concerns around the jobs in a particular jurisdiction for somebody who didn't take any money at all from a company. So, you know, with that little aside, you know, the point is, you know, if we're concerned about labor and environmental standards, we should be dealing with it from the point of view of labor and environmental regulation, and, you know, advocating for those kinds of things is really what makes sense. And I guess I bring all this forward from the perspective of a campaigner or change maker. You know, like, if you only have so many hours in the day and there's only so many things you can ask other people to do and to focus on and to pay attention to, you know, it's sometimes a lot easier to suggest a boycott or, you know, changing your consumption choices than it is to, you know, suggest that we change the laws themselves and, you know, and change the underlying structure. Somehow it's less sexy than just going after a particular company. And, you know, there's definitely times when we should go after particular companies. You know, there's particular moments where a company does something that that we should be paying attention to. And, you know, and we should be getting other people to pay attention to it. But it also can be problematic if we go so far down the road as to build strategies around simply focusing on companies and not focusing on regulations. Like, you know, by focusing on antitrust, you could do a lot more to limit the power of Amazon than organizing a boycott, as one example. And frankly, I think to a certain extent, like, some of these, you know, shop with your dollar ideas, and this will sound a little conspiratorial, but, you know, I actually think it's a very deliberate effort from industry that goes back quite a ways to get ourselves to think of ourselves as consumers before we think of ourselves as citizens. And, you know, and some of this, you know, lack of faith in government that we have these days is actually very beneficial to industry, because we kind of fall back on this idea of, well, markets will kind of make things make sense, and, you know, we can make choices that affect industry in those marketplaces, and, you know, and we can even collectively act and, you know, exert pressure. And again, there are times when that makes sense, but in the grand scheme of things, you know, we really need to not lose sight of the power that we have, you know, as agents in a democracy. You know, and frankly, one of the biggest problems that we have is that we don't think in terms of structural change nearly enough, not just in terms of the rules that govern corporations, but also the structures of our government. You know, we just recently had this electoral reform referendum in British Columbia, but frankly, that was just rearranging the deck chairs of the Titanic to a certain extent. Like, you know, the structure of government has not changed in many, many years, and frankly, just getting a better distribution of political parties is not going to solve all of our problems. Not that, you know, any one structural change is going to solve all of our problems, but, you know, it definitely does matter how our government is structured. And, you know, I was a big supporter of electoral reform. I have been for years. I think it's a horrible shame that that didn't go through in British Columbia. But I also think there would have been a ton more work still to do in BC. You know, and often in the United States, we hear people talking about the need for, you know, the changes to the way that funding of elections and of political parties is done. Don't disagree at all. But it's worth noting as a Canadian that we've actually had much better rules in terms of funding in Canada for many years. And in fact, through much of that, Stephen Harper, who was one of the, you know, worst prime ministers we ever had, if, you know, you're concerned about labor and environmental standards, you know, he was in power right in the midst of having, you know, pretty strict laws, in fact, stronger ones than a lot of the ones that are suggested in the United States. You know, the way I've kind of put that at times is, you know, if you're the Bad News Bears playing the Chicago Cubs, you know, it doesn't matter where you're playing softball or hardball, like, you know, there's still just way more resources to be brought to bear in terms of, you know, affecting change. So, you know, it's important for us to remember that, you know, as much as some of these structural changes are going to have some impact, you know, there are much bigger changes that are perhaps outside the scope of what we're even thinking about that, you know, maybe should be part of our analysis. Like, you know, for example, you know, here this will perhaps sound a bit radical, but, you know, why do we give corporations the ability to be privately traded corporations that, you know, are mandated to maximize profit on behalf of shareholders, you know, just carte blanche. Like, why, for example, do we give tobacco companies a mandate to maximize profit on behalf of their shareholders and then spend billions of dollars fighting them in court, trying to regulate them, trying to minimize the harm they're doing, fighting over what they can advertise or what they can't, when the reality is that we've basically set up this machine to do everything in its power to ensure that they're able to continue to do as much harm as possible. You know, should we be considering, and I think we should, you know, who we give corporate charters to based on what kind of a business they're running? You know, there are lots of examples where we do things differently. You know, for example, in Canada, we have crown corporations, like, for example, you know, how we handle the sale and distribution of alcohol. You know, this is different in other countries, of course, but in Canada, you know, we have crown corporations that are given the task of, yes, making money, but also controlling a dangerous substance for a larger social good. And actually, in some other places in the world, this is what's done with tobacco, just to kind of continue with that. It is. Look at that. Cool. All right. Yeah, so I guess the point I was trying to make here is, like, are there structural ways that we could make much bigger change? Antitrust laws definitely are a significant one to think about. You know, there are these massive corporations that are, you know, just given way too much power, and we can break them up. Like, we already have tools to do it. We've used them before. You might remember that they were used against Microsoft in years gone by. But also, you know, there's ways that we could be restructuring, you know, companies to have a profit motive or not. Like, why do we say to a tobacco company, you know, please go and maximize profit on behalf of your shareholders? We'll create a structure that gives you the ability to do that. Not only the ability to do that, but that makes that your modus operandi. You know, it makes it your core function is to be an entity that's trying to maximize profit. And in fact, if you don't, you can be held liable by your shareholders. You know, this is a machine for trying to make money and push investment in the stock market. And it's a very effective and useful tool, but it's something that we should, you know, not just do blindly. You know, this is a special legal structure that, you know, when we first came out with the limited liability company that shields investors from liability, that, you know, mandates directors to maximize profit. Like, this is something that was done to try to raise money for big projects. It was done in a very limited capacity. And we've basically taken that because of its ability to just, like, drive dramatic amounts of investment and just applied it to basically anybody who wants to start a corporation is the way it seems. And, you know, there are shades of gray, though. You know, and Canada's not the only country that does this. You know, and it's something that doesn't either have to be state-run or private. There is this kind of middles, that, you know, whole space of all kinds of entities that can... Thank you. And I will say thanks for listening for all 27-ish minutes. Hope you're having a lovely day. Hope you're finding some time with family and friends and, you know, getting a little bit of a respite from the rat race to enjoy the great outdoors. And whether you're in somewhere cold or somewhere hot, I hope life's treating you well. Okay, have a good one.